Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. I have had the pleasure of talking to some of the leading authors, artists, activists, and change makers of our time on this podcast. And I want to personally thank you for subscribing, listening, and sharing 100 plus episodes over 100,000 times. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy. And I look forward to more conversations with those important voices that will bring clarity to the situation we find ourselves in as we move toward November of 2024. If you appreciate these conversations and my cultural and political commentary, please subscribe to this podcast, In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, on your favorite platform, and to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. I'd really appreciate the help. Thank you.
One of the problems that I think we see across communities, and I think social media does both things, it both reaffirms this, but also might disrupt it too, is that we tend to affiliate with people who share a lot of similarities with ourselves. And I think that's very much the same within the LGBTQ plus acronym. And again, I think that's reinforced in various ways that are systemic, economic, and political, and especially when we're under such attack. And as far as the Unruly Alliance as intervention, what that really means is radically looking toward the other and the other's concerns that may not share even any aspect of your identity, really. But I think unless we're able to extend beyond our own horizon line and beyond our own vision, it's going to be difficult to fight against these other very large, grave political dynamics that we're seeing right now.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, and this is a podcast that I do called In Conversation with Frank Schaefer. And my guest today is Professor K. Allison Hammer. She's assistant professor and coordinator of women, gender, and sexuality studies at Southern Illinois University, and she is the author of Masculinity in Transition, a new book, which I have read carefully and with only one complaint, by the way, and that is I like reading books on paper, and I read this as a PDF. Mm-hmm. And
it's such a nice book, too.
Yes, it looks beautiful. Yeah. Well, one of my frustrations is I can't hold it up and show it to people, which I would do normally. So I'm going to ask you to hold your own book up once in a while.
Okay, I will do that. Yeah,
it's a good cover, by the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
I'm really happy with it.
Is it actually out yet?
It is. It was just published on October 17th.
Okay, so there's an excuse for why I got a PDF.
Yeah. Yeah, we planned this conversation a while ago.
Yeah, and where are you sitting right now?
I'm sitting in my home, actually.
But where are you at? Do you live near the school you teach in, or where?
I do. I'm in a very small town of about 20,000 people called Carbondale, okay. Illinois, in the very southern edge of Illinois.
Yeah, and how long have you been teaching at the school?
I just arrived here
from
3 months ago. From Tennessee.
Doing
I was
what
teaching now? At Vanderbilt. Prior, I was teaching at Vanderbilt in the gender and sexuality studies department there. So I just got this position a few months ago. So I've gone from Tennessee to Illinois.
It's a very
interesting transition. Thank you.
And is the new position a step up in terms of, you know, tenure track and all that good stuff?
Yeah, it took about 6 years total to get from graduate school to a tenure track position.
So you have paid your dues.
I have.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah, that's great. And then just tell me, to fill in the blanks, have you published other books?
I have not. This is my very first book. I've published a slew of other articles on similar topics of gender nonconformity and history. So this is my very first monograph, though.
Yeah. Well, anyway, diving into the book a little bit here, I wanted to go, and again, I'm disadvantaged because I'm doing this on the computer, to something out of the introduction I wanted to read. And I hope once I've read it, you'll feel that I've picked a passage properly to introduce your topic. And then I have other quotes I want to read from the book itself as we talk. And this is from Allison's book, Trans and homonormativity can compel the formation of what Jacques Derrida describes as a kind of shadow brotherhood in which fraternity is replicated by outsiders who may ironically nurture dreams of patriarchy's demise. Such bands of outsiders only mirror the bonds of fraternity and neoliberal logic, even while remaining outside of normative alignments of sex and gender. The cliche LGBTQIA plus community is often based on sympathy between members of groups with similar identity labels, but these sympathies can be easily contradicted by new racisms or chauvinisms. Underscoring the limits of identity politics, focused on the personal, cultural critic and historian Nikhil Pal Singh warns that personal commitment is not a substitute for systematic change, which was a nice thing you pulled out of his. But I was just trying to find something in the book, and I was searching all through that kind of gave the flavor of the book, but also kind of what the book is about. And so I want to jump to another idea of yours, and this idea of unruly alliance, which I guess is your cure for this, what he's talking about and what you're talking about in that passage of really looking at something systemic outside of simply latching on to the present day form and replicating it. Okay, I've talked for too long. I'm supposed to be interviewing you, but that's my best shot of getting into the material. So could you fire away?
Right. So we'll take the first one to begin. So one of the problems that I think we see across communities, and I think social media does both things, it both reaffirms this, but also might disrupt it too, is that we tend to affiliate with people who share a lot of similarities with ourselves, particularly racial categories, but also class. And I think that's very much the same within the LGBTQ plus acronym. And again, I think that's reinforced in various ways that are systemic, economic, and political, and especially when we're under such attack. And as far as the unruly alliance as intervention, what that really means is radically looking toward the other and the other's concerns that may not share even any aspect of your identity, really. And I kind of sprinkle many examples of this throughout the book that I think unless we're able to extend beyond our own horizon line and beyond our own vision, it's going to be difficult to fight against these other very large, grave political dynamics that we're seeing right now.
Well, one of the places in the book you concentrate on this is in the chapter, I forget which chapter it is, maybe one of the later chapters, where you're talking about the union movement and labor. And I think that's a very good example of where these ships are passing in the night and don't talk to each other, almost as if they're living in sealed compartments. I live next to a boatyard, and my friend Scott, whose family's been in the boat building and boat repair business for years, is a very hands-on working guy, one of the brightest people I know. And, you know, when I'm doing my hobby is building, and I've renovated this 1835 house we're in for the last 43 years while we've lived here. And, you know, Scott is someone who comes, he's white and would be working class, also incredibly bright, hasn't gone to university and so forth. And he divides the human race into two categories. So the newcomers, other people, but also he'll describe someone he's been talking to as in he don't know shit. In other words, there's no connection between actually knowing how to do anything, say build a new chimney that you're going to use, and this kind of rarefied Boston area college elite educated people mix in our neighborhood, a neighborhood that used to be all fishermen and working people, is sort of halfway gentrified now. And so, you know, we'll be describing a new neighbor moving in and they're building so-and-so, and he says, oh, you don't know shit. And basically what he means is there's no hands-on tactile relationship with the environment. And they will look at him as this working class guy who they would never think of having an intelligent conversation with. He's smarter than they are. And in a crisis, he'd be the person to know, not them, because they literally don't know shit and they can't do anything. they may teach at Harvard or they're a doctor and a pediatrician or whatever, but you know, we're right on the edge of a joke about how many people it would take to screw in a light bulb. No practicality at all. And since I'm sandwiched between several different kinds of neighbors, I really identified with the chapter where you're talking about unions and trying to reach out and so forth. And so I know we're skipping way into the book, but talk a little bit about that aspect of your crusade, if I can use that word.
Yeah.
Change the way we think. And the inability of the educated white class, which I think is powerful and has a lot more, and we'll get into this, you know, there's a lot more about color than there is about gender here. And I just wonder whether you have some thoughts you want to amplify on what your book says about these issues that I don't want to tell back to you, and what you think like right now while we're talking.
I would love to talk about that last chapter. I was just rereading it actually. And the interesting thing about that chapter is I take a novel that is very, very well read in academia. It's taught in all kinds of academic classes. And it was really held up for its focus on the romantic narrative between a butch and a femme, right?
Yeah.
Which is still used, that language is still used very, very differently and very widely now. But in that era, it was really when you were a lesbian, you were either a butch or you were a femme for the most part. And that had its own rigidity. But anyway, the novel was read as a romantic story. But what I'm doing with the novel, and it's very new actually, but it's also very old, is to really concentrate on how the author, who has since passed, really constructs the history of American labor through these stories. So for example, the two romantic partners meet in a cannery. And that's often not focused on, but what's interesting about that novel is it had a wide readership outside of the white elite academia, which we're oversimplifying, but that's fine. And so going back to Feinberg's original purpose in writing the novel, I think brings us very much into the present moment where, of course, we're having all of this strike activity, you know, but to keep it in perspective here, I mean, you know, the union numbers are way, 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 way smaller than they were in the post-war years where the novel sort of begins. But one of the things that I see as promising, and I don't mention this in the book because it's relatively recent in terms of when I was doing research, but the bond that's happening between the UAW and the grad students is fascinating. So grad students who are feeling very much disenfranchised as laborers, including adjunct labor, which a lot of universities are running primarily on adjunct labor now, are seeing common cause with the UAW and they with them. And so there's a way in which these really kind of very unexpected, very ephemeral, very kind of out of this necessity of the moment, which is something I stress kind of throughout too. There's this new unruly alliance that's formed between two groups that normally, as in your neighborhood, would not mix, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I really enjoyed that part of the book. Another thing, and I'm jumping around a little here. By the way, I have a better plan than this, but we'll get to the plan in a minute.
That's okay. I love it. It's unruly and I love it.
One of the things I really liked about your book a lot as someone, because I'm not assuming you know anything about me, but I've had a couple of careers and one of them was directing shitty movies in Hollywood. I made four Hollywood features back in the 80s and left that and started writing novels and was successful enough as a writer to have permission to make a life as a writer who earns their living doing that. But that's a long time ago. But that said, I'm very interested in film and I really enjoyed your, I won't call it film criticism exactly, but film exploration as a kind of proof of social change and politics, philosophy, how it intersects with the issues you're talking about. But, you know, you went way past that with a look at some of the made for television stuff like Deadwood and so forth and so on. I really loved your writing on that. So, you know, if you don't keep your day job and you want to write about something else, I would urge you to get into film criticism and film review because you seem to really have a good handle on it. The other day I was watching you in an interview that came out yesterday, I think some academic thing where you guys were talking about Barbie a little bit and so
oh,
forth.
Oh, yeah. That, yeah.
And I liked your take on that too. And mm-hmm. I just wonder, where does that come from? What's your relationship to the cinema, to television and mm-hmm. popular energy? Because you also had a really good take on stuff made in the 40s and 50s. I'm 71. I think in the last program, you said you were
49.
39 or 49.
49.
Like mm-hmm. So kind of halfway. Yeah. We're sort of whatever. But you were talking about movies that I saw as a teenager in the original. In other words, really saw them, didn't study them. And you seem to get a lot about the movies. So tell me about you and movies. What's the deal here? I was surprised to find half your book seemed to be about movies. Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. If you appreciate my cultural and political commentary, please do me a favor and subscribe to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. You can subscribe for free, or you can kick in a couple of dollars a month and help me out and help me keep this going if you're able. Either way, I'm incredibly grateful for your support and most of all for your participation. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy as we move toward November of 2024. And every subscription helps create, build, sustain, and put voice to this movement for truth. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's really a good question. So I grew up on TV. I was practically raised by TV, I feel. And I was in that era of parenting where we kind of had free reign of the TV and we got to watch whatever we wanted, at least in my family. So there was very little supervision. So I watched things that I probably shouldn't have watched. But I think it really merged with my, I'm a reader, right? That's kind of a lot of what, I'm a reader of people and I'm a reader of texts. And so, and I think film, specifically for American culture, is just so central to, you know, whether it be propagandistic roles that film has played. I'm doing something right now on film noir and some of the ways that progressive views were very shut down in that early McCarthy era, starting to be anyway. The Western, you know, I've always been fascinated by John Wayne, and it comes from also hearing people like James Baldwin, for example. And I mentioned this anecdote in the book that, you know, he grew up watching cowboy films because that's what were on TV. And that he didn't know he was rooting for the wrong side. But I think the cowboy film in particular just gives us so much information about the American project. And also it really tracks with politics, like throughout its history. So for example, the example you gave of Deadwood is an example of a show that was created in response to 9/11. And all of the shoring up of gender and masculinity, and we have to fight the enemy, and there were no women protagonists in that era, like right up until 2016.
Well, Calamity Jane shows up.
Calamity Jane, but I do a little takedown of that too, that it's my definition of a feminist Western is that it has to be a group formation of women who are taking on the system.
And you talk in detail about women who have not connected with each other in the film to make common cause. They're just sort of an individual odd thing. I forget there's a name for it now. I should have made a little note, but it's not Butch.
Yeah, that's good enough. Like that anyway,
they're an individual oddity. They're not another community.
Right. Yeah. So I think it's very interesting also that it matches up with the Me Too movement, which I don't think that Godless or Westworld, the two shows that I talk about in that chapter, were conscious, obviously, because Me Too comes out around 2017. But they very much align with that movement and what was brewing at that time. And that also really shaped the book as well. You know, the events of Me Too. And we can get into that if you want. But I think as far as film is concerned, you know, I watch a lot of old films and I like them also for their simplicity in contrast to contemporary film, where there isn't a lot of technological capability, which makes some of them kind of clunky and kind of, for that reason, humanized, I want to say. But really, you know, the Western begins with the advent of film. And we still make Westerns today. And really, I can't think of another genre with that kind of longevity, specifically because of the consistency in them, unlike crime films, which kind of take on different balances depending on the technological era that we're in. They're always set in the same time period with always the same props. And the railroad is kind of this signifier of change. And that's right up until, you know, Westworld is the first season. So, yeah.
Yeah, I found everything on film, wonderful to read in the book, but also just the way you were extending that into looking at other things of both being a shaper and reflection of the culture. And I would take it a step further, having grown up in Switzerland and go to British boarding schools, it was also a shaper of non-American perceptions of America. So our Westerns were our ambassadors to the world, unfortunately, depending on your point of view, but they were looked at as, even to this day, some leader from another country will describe an American leader they don't like as, he's just a cowboy, or something like that. And then they get all that stuff. Let me go back here to where I would normally begin one of my interviews. I write for a living, and a lot of my books, I've written 5 novels, but my nonfiction tends to be a bit memoirish. Mm-hmm. And I'm very lucky, unlike you, and that is I have not been trying to write for an academic community, which means that I'm just trying to communicate directly with my reader, whoever that reader is.
Right.
And so I can do things that you don't do in your book, or at least don't do much of, and that is really talk about my own motivation for writing the book within the book, like who I am. And so I'm going to ask you some questions of things I would have liked to have read in the book. I was touched by you talking about your stepfather as being mm-hmm. someone who was so supportive of you at a certain time of your life in terms of some of your own journey. And I would really like to go there to the extent that you'll share with me.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And all I can say is you're talking to someone who has had remarkable conversations with people who have told me a lot of stuff in these conversations, some of whom have read my work and therefore know that, I don't shy away from the kind of vulnerabilities of being willing to, both look bad and also just talk about where I came from and who I am. I came from an evangelical background, right-wing politics. I was the sidekick to my father, who was basically the key formation of the Republican Party's litmus test on abortion. Been there, done that. I've seen everything, been a fly on the wall when it comes to that, and I've written about it. So how can I put this? I want to know more about you.
Yeah, sure.
I want to know where the book came from mm-hmm. and what demons you're trying to lay to rest in an academic book that the book can't be about, or you don't get published by an academic press. But, mm-hmm.
I would love to.
Why did you write the book?
Yeah. And I have read your history, and I haven't read too much of your work, but I'm very curious. This is another aside, but I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on some of the HIV/AIDS chapter as well, and some of what happened in that era as far as anti-gay rhetoric nearing the present.
Although I'll just throw a little anecdote in here.
Yes.
And we'll come back to it.
Yeah.
T. Everett Koop, who was the co-author of the book that my dad wrote, Whatever Happened to Human Race, that became the movie that became the pro-life movement. And I was out there as their sidekick. Chick Koop and I were very good friends. And when he became Surgeon General, interestingly enough, he went against form and became, what they call a rhino now. The conservative Republicans were furious with him because he actually treated the gay community with great dignity and was advocating for research into AIDS and treating it as a medical problem, including advocacy in a way that ran completely counter to who you would think he was. Which brings up a point, and that is there's a lot of people I think that are better than their fill in the blank, theology, philosophy, politics, whatever they seem to be. And Chick was one of those guys. When it came to that, he was much more enlightened and more compassionate than one would have thought looking at the rest of his life. That said, let's get back to who you are and why you wrote the book.
Right. So I was in a straight marriage until 2010. And I came out as a lesbian at that time. and, you know, wasn't really thinking about it as an issue with my gender. I was much more thinking, okay, I know that I don't want to be married to a man, but that was about as far as it went. I do have a child with that person. And it was a really difficult thing to do at, you know, 35 years old or whatever. And that's
and how
also
old is
when
your
my
child at that time?
He was 2.
Okay.
So it was a very difficult thing to get out of, because my ex had a very antagonistic relationship to that coming out and continued that for many decades after, or at least a decade and a half after. And so I wasn't thinking about it as a gender crisis, though, but I was getting back into my education. We were living in a really small town in Wyoming at the time. And I went to the University of Wyoming because I knew that I needed to also get out of the town that we were living in, which we had gone there for his job. And so I started out in American studies, which I don't know if you know about American studies. It's history and literature combined originally, but it's taken on a real political progressive meaning. But I decided to do English because it was really my original love. I started out as a visual artist. And so I switched to doing English, and I became really interested in Americanness. And I think it's not unrelated to my experiences with my father, who was worked in industrial sales. My mom was a teacher. I didn't even know academic was a job.
Any
so it's
religion
not...
in that family and household?
My mom is Christian. My dad is a grumpy atheist. He calls himself agnostic, actually. I shouldn't say that. And he later became a Trumper. So that was, you know, very painful. And that also ties into the book as well.
Now, that's your father, not your stepfather you talked
yes,
about.
That's
your
my
Buddhist stepfather. It seemed
my
like
biological dad.
Yeah.
My biological dad. Yeah. Anyway, as I got into my lesbian identity, I just started to feel that it wasn't really fitting as a label, and started to question my gender identity, which at the time, you have to remember, was not that controversial.
Right.
You know, these were the Obama years. People did not really know about trans people yet because Laverne Cox had not come on to Orange is the New Black. It wasn't the 2014 tipping point yet. But it wasn't really until the language of non-binary, which I can explain sort of what that means for me, came around that I felt like this language makes sense to me. And it was from the generation below me. I mean, it was from my students, really. My colleagues
were
not.
But you also mentioned in that other interview how they supported you and gave you the courage to do your thing.
Yes. Yeah. And not always from my colleagues. And there's a lot of, so the other issue within the LGBTQ acronym, I do not say community because I don't always think it's a community. I think there are very various communities within that acronym that don't always speak to each other. Mm-hmm. And I got a lot of resistance from lesbians, from colleagues, because they felt that I was going over to the other side of
the other
masculinity.
Side being what in their view?
Masculinity.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're joining the other team.
I'm joining the other team
while writing a book about what's wrong with white males, and all of a sudden you're one of them.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Being facetious.
I use they them pronouns. Like I can talk about what that means for me and what my relationship to it is, but I think that is a question on my mind, right? Like I was abused by my brother. I was abused by my father, both white men. I have had very abusive situations with white men and now had an ex who was abusing me through the courts. So all of this adds up to me asking a very fundamental question about if I'm moving toward masculinity, what exactly am I moving toward, right? And this is where my stepdad really comes into the picture. We lived together for a period of time in a multi-generational household. I do not have custody of my son today because of the whole mess with the courts, but he was in the mix. And I lived with them, and, you know, partly it was out of a mutual necessity. They needed care. I needed care too. And it was an arrangement that worked for us for a period of about 5 years. And he's a Buddhist, was a Buddhist. And we meditated, and he taught me his sutras, and he taught me his viewpoint. And a couple of the most stunning things about him that I feel should be part of whatever we call a revised masculinity is he was always open to change, and he was always open to the other. And if that other was trans, great. If that other was a Black person who is of low income, great. I mean, I distinctly remember we used to go to this church in Nashville that was a queer church, because it was kind of a really exciting place to be in Nashville, to be at this queer church in the middle of a very, very red state, where he brought a person who was unhoused into the church because he wanted to, you know, introduce him to people. And I remember at that point, I was like, wow, we have a long way to go. Because these supposedly progressive people looked at him like, we don't want you in our space, you smell, sort of thing. That's the kind of person that he was. And unfortunately, he passed right before the book was published. And that's really sad for me, but I also feel like he's with me. And he was with me all along when I needed a father. When my father and I decided it was no longer productive for us to speak, that was when that relationship became important on both sides. So
I'm going to just reintroduce you. This is a podcast called In Conversation with Frank Schaefer. And if you like it, please like it in the online sense of sharing this with other people and doing all those things people do, so that others can hear about it. It's first a live event on Facebook, then goes to YouTube and other video outlets, and then to a number of places where podcasts are heard. I do a commentary called It Has to Be Said, which is also on Facebook and so forth and so on. And I'm the author of various books, some of which you may have heard of. Other than that, my guest today is Professor K. Allison Hammer, assistant professor and coordinator of women, gender, and sexuality studies at Southern Illinois University, and author of a book I just finished this morning in preparation for this interview, Masculinity in Transition. So I want to go to a line in the book. And there it is. No, hold it up again in all seriousness, because I read it as PDF, and it's a lovely cover.
I'll send you one for sure.
So there was a line in the book that, in terms of this idea of unruly alliances, I need to ask you about, and I'm not quibbling, but you talk about the sadism and masochism of white boys. And the line jumped out in the sense that I was looking at it, and I don't think this is what you meant, but I was wondering why you're talking about white boys only rather than just boys. I lived in Africa for a year. I went to British boarding schools with people from all sorts of countries. You know, I don't think the Saudi Arabian royal family is made up of white boys, but they have women raped in prisons who don't want to go along with them. I don't think the problem has anything to do with color at all. I think masculinity is a global phenomena that comes from deep from evolution. And I'll go one step further. And that is, I think the reverse is true too. One of my favorite books that actually changed the way I think was by Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, who was the daughter of the founder of Raytheon, whose parents took her out of school for 5 years when she was a teenager. And two of those they spent in the Kalahari Desert with a group of hunter-gatherers that her parents were interested in and her mother was interested in, that had never had contact with anybody. And what was so encouraging about her book, which is why it changed the way I think about a lot of things, was, without using this terminology, she really talks about the survival of the friendliest and cooperation being the driving impetus of evolution and why you and I are talking here today. The same thing that Margaret Mead was talking about when she said the first dawn of civilization was when you can find skeletal or fossil remains of human bones that have healed, because it proves someone took care of a broken person. And I loved her book because suddenly I'm looking at a hunter-gatherer collection of, quote, primitive people who basically are living in an egalitarian tribal situation from which we could learn. And they had been doing this, and this is not a misprint, for 80,000 years, okay? And they were there in these groups because women didn't just get a say. they were in a truly equal position with the males. And she did not, I want to point this out, she did not write this book, nor did her mother do the research as part of a women's study program in the 1970s. This is in the 50s.
That didn't exist yet.
this wasn't made up stuff as part of a more modern mid-20th century cause. This was just observation. So What was interesting to me about that book was that everything that we're aiming for here in terms of what you're talking about in your book, when I say everything, obviously, there's no such thing as perfection, but it actually existed in a pre-industrial, pre-agrarian culture, pre-capitalistic, and no religion at all that we would recognize as religion, and yet very, mm-hmm. a very moral-centered people. Okay, I'm saying this because I think the reverse is true. I want to tax your book with something and ask you about your own academic community. I think that neoliberal Western capitalism is a problem, but it's a problem. There's mm-hmm. a much more fundamental problem, and that is post-agrarian industrialist societies are racist, they are blinkered, they are homophobic, they are anti-woman, they're cruel, and I think white would be the last thing you have on the list. I just think racial supremacy, you know, in the same way that I remember all my leftist friends in the 60s holding up the pollution that was beginning to become an issue in the 60s and 70s as an example of Western capitalism, when actually it was the communist countries in the East that were destroying the planet sure. at twice the rate of any capitalist nation.
Sure.
So I just want to throw that out and just say, I found that odd. I mean, what's with white males being the problem? Okay, they are a problem, but they're a problem because they're male. They're a problem because they're male. My journey as a male, that doesn't come from a problematic being white. It comes from me being a male, raised to dominate women, raised to boss people around.
Well, I kind of disagree with that. I think only because of the long history of white supremacy in the United States and the fact that when those two come together, that's been a real alibi for the disenfranchisement of Indigenous people, of Black people, of Brown people. And if you look at our politics and you look at our Congress and you look at, the real concentration of white masculinity within those spaces. But more than that, someone like Clarence Thomas is absorbing all of that, right? And he is part of that widening circle of perpetrators. And I think I want to clarify something, though. It's not that I don't think there are normativities and toxicities within communities of color. That is definitely not what I'm saying, which is why I bring forward Marlon Riggs's film that was made in the 1980s. Where he's critiquing within his own community as a Black gay man as well. But I think it's the bigger dynamic of internal colonialism in the United States and also our imperial fantasies of world domination vis-a-vis an out of control military industrial complex that is currently at $101 billion per year and climbing. So I would say that for me, whiteness was very important, and it was very important for a few reasons that also have to do with the LGBTQ community. So one of the things that I've picked up on is that not all trans people are suffering the same kinds of consequences. I mean, we are currently pawns in the current system. We're a very small demographic at that, which is convenient because, if the Democrats lose a few votes, it's not really that big of a deal overall, et cetera, et cetera. The mobilizing of groups sort of in competition with each other. But that white trans men, right, have a different set of things going on. And actually, there was one scholar who reported that when he transitioned to becoming male, that actually he felt like he was becoming more white at the same time. And so I think it's oftentimes that with trans people, you can see what the basket of privileges on offer are when you begin to transition. And I want to be clear that I'm talking really specifically about the United States. And I agree with you entirely that, Indigenous cultures have a lot to teach us, as do disenfranchised Black and Brown communities as well. And that I think it's not every white man that we're talking about here, because that was the old feminist stance. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to point out that masculinity has to be negotiated within certain specific spaces. Mm. Otherwise, why would we have the word mansplaining used so widely?
Sure.
And I'll talk about the Me Too movement too. I mean, the Me Too movement has resulted in very few consequences. And a lot of those men were white. There were some Black men there as well and people of color, but so the statistics on this are that 201 men lost their jobs, but there have really been few legal consequences for the accused. And that overall, you know, the burden of proof is so high that if you were to reverse it and think about whether the claims would be legitimate for a person of color also, that's where you start to get into the dominance of whiteness in our society overall. That it's been a very ineffective strategy to deal with our courts for that reason with Me Too.
Yeah, no, I like your explanation, and I wanted to zero in on that because I think that, you know, if I was reviewing the book as an enemy of your viewpoint, which I am not, I would pull that line out and I would just say, you know, here we go again. And I think the American left suffers from something that maybe I have a slightly different perspective on, having lived the first, 25 years of my life in Europe and then gone to boarding schools in Britain. The second one I ran away from and got all the way to Holland, by the way, without a passport. It was quite an achievement at age 15. Having lived in South Africa and shot two films there back in my feature filmmaking days and so forth and so on. My mom was born in China to missionary parents. We've always had a kind of an outlook of a slightly different one. I'm kind of a re-immigrant to America. My parents were American, so I have an American passport, but I never lived here until I was a married man with two kids and a third on the way. My wife's from San Francisco. But I think we can get caught up sometimes in the American situation, and especially from the left or the right, zero in on the truths of what we face, forgetting that there's a larger context. And
right.
Mm-hmm. I can just say, you know, I I'm going to sound like a Trumper here, which I am not. I think he's the most vile creature that has ever existed. But, you know, we are only having this discussion today without you being in prison somewhere or dead, because we are not in Tehran or Saudi Arabia or any of the countries that are known as Islamic countries. And yet somehow a book like yours, if you're from another planet, you would think that the situation we face here in the United States is the best example of sexism or racism. Mm. Slavery was legal in Saudi Arabia until 1966, basically.
Right.
And the same in a lot of Middle Eastern countries. And it was nothing to do with any post-colonial reality that had been imposed by the West. This is the same culture that came out of the desert in the 7th century and conquered North Africa. And it was nothing to do with the United States or Britain or colonial powers. And I would just like to say that two points. I think we are in a worldwide combat against theocracy, period. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Hindu nationalism or Islam or radical white supremacist American Christianity, these are the same people. So the settlers on the West Bank, the Trumpers in the Trump cult, are all energized by the same sort of idea.
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Well, the Saudis are the same thing. And now the Chinese are rediscovering their imperial ideas that predate Western imperial ideas by 5,000 years. So I would say we have a global situation. A lot has to be said about, you know, white American males, white hegemony over the planet, colonialism and all the rest. But it can't become an excuse to not face the fact that we human beings are so terminally fucked up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Everything about us is twisted.
Mm-hmm. And I have no beef with what you're saying. I think that what I find really frustrating, though, in conversations about America, about the United States, is that a lot of people who are otherwise quite educated don't know some of these histories. And we don't know some of these histories because of our own exceptionalism. And I think calling that out is really important. Like, The book that you're describing is a book I want to write, but I want to view it through the eyes of the American military, because like I said, we spend almost double what China spends on military a year. Yeah. I mean, we have military outposts in every corner of the globe. Like, it's unprecedented, yeah. really. And I think that we can do both things, right? We can acknowledge that also, you know, the Republicans are taking a lot from Viktor Orban right now. I mean, they held Absolutely. CPAC in Budapest, Hungary this year, and they're yeah. taking a lot of their ideas from Orban in terms of gender policing as well.
Well, even Putin, and a lot of they're taking ideas from Vladimir yeah, Putin.
I know.
Tucker
right.
Carlson, this right. is his whole thing. He's mm-hmm. defending Western Christianity.
Yeah, so I think there are limitations to the study that I'm doing, and I'm not going to deny that, but I think it really came out of my own need to fill in the gaps, because a lot of these histories I wasn't taught, right? There were a lot of ins and outs that I needed to educate myself about. And so that was a lot of it for me, was what I take issue with in terms of exceptionalism is we have this view of ourselves. And then the reality is very different from that view. And I would put liberals in that category very much so as well. And I think that has a lot to do with a propagandistic media structure overall. And that's not to sound like a Trumper either.
Right.
That's merely to say that the ways in which things are framed are very problematic when it comes to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And our sort of self-centeredness, I'm hoping I'm calling out in that book too, because it's like, you know, I'll just give you a really funny example. My wife is German and actually just moved here 2 months before January 6th. So January 6th was her introduction to American life.
Yeah, welcome right? to America, right?
Uh-huh. Now, I was relatively numb to this event because of what we had experienced up until that point as a society. I was kind of like, that makes sense to me. But it wasn't until I wrote this book that it actually started to make sense to me, that all the pieces started to come together historically, like really across the entire second half of the 20th century, you know, much, much so, you know. In Germany, in public schools, they teach for all public school students. I'm not sure if that's across the board. They use American media as a text example for propaganda. We yeah. don't think of ourselves that way. We think of other societies as being that way, sure. but particularly when it comes to gay rights, we're very good at saying, oh, well, at least you're not dead or in jail.
Yeah.
But I felt very much like my life was in danger in Tennessee when the Proud Boys decided to march in the Capitol, led by the state senator, saying that we're mutilating children at the yeah. Vanderbilt University Medical Clinic. So I can say to you that, no, I'm not in jail. No, I'm not dead. Am I feeling threatened right now? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because what it does is it gives people a license to commit violence, and, you know, especially against Black trans people of color. So I can tell you that there was a lot I didn't know. There was a lot that was excluded from my own education, you know?
You know, I guess my point is that I have a little more of a jaundiced view of the US, and I just include the world in it as well. And I think one of the things that some of my friends in the Democratic Party structure, of whom I know some folks, have been kind of shocked at, that I actually predicted a long time ago, and in an I told you so moment. And that was looking to the Hispanic vote of a growing community of people to somehow bail out the Democratic Party. And I said, excuse me, have you ever been in a Pentecostal church? Do you know what the theology of this group is? Mm-hmm. That the people coming across the border are the most traditional of all Roman Catholics and or yeah. Pentecostal Christians. Do you understand that the people who will reach out to them is not you, because you don't speak their language? I'm not speaking to you out there. Those
yes, I understand.
and they will be welcomed into the white evangelical community as fellow travelers, united in their pro-life stand, in their anti-gay stand, in their commitment to traditional macho South American and Central American culture, coming straight out of Spain, that has nothing to do with your story or our story goes far, far back into, you know, Edward III and chivalry in the 14th century and 15th century and 13th century in Europe and all the rest of it. Do you understand what you're getting here? I said this a long time ago to people in the Democratic Party, to Nancy Pelosi, for instance, when I was in her home, and got a totally blank stare. And now a third of the vote of the Hispanic community is trending that way. And it's going to be the same for the Indian vote, with the Hindu nationalism being very popular.
Absolutely.
So all I'm trying to say, and I'm not trying to be difficult here, but I think, again, that the use of the term white as in a kind of a coverall for hegemony and the point of view that is going to endanger you, Allison, and threaten you, is not wrong, because the white male dominated community is as much of a threat as you think it is. That is the Proud Boys, that is Trump's voter. But we have a global problem, and the left wing idea that somehow brown is better and that they're going to solve our problems.
I don't think the skin color
makes any difference. I think it's the theology we've got to talk about.
I don't say that, but I think that if we look at the facts on the ground and we look at the amount of wealth that certain white men in power have amassed, that is really outstripping any kind of system that we know of, really, right, in terms of the concentration of global wealth in the hands of Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, you know, these folks, and also political power. It's not so much about the everyday that I'm thinking of. I'm also thinking of political and economic power and where that is concentrated. And I don't think it would take much rhetorical reading skills to look at who those folks really are, sure, right? And sure, why. So I think that's really more where the argument pivots for me. It's not so much that there aren't extreme forms of toxicity or normativity or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm, around the world. But I think as far as Europe and the United States is concerned, you know, I take a lot of cues from my wife, right? Mm. That I always looked at Europe as sort of this utopia where I wanted to go live one day. And I think I got that from my father, who always kind of wanted to return to Germany, to the old world. And there were definitely Nazis in my family history as well. And so the problem in Europe is migration. When it comes down to it, some of even the social democracies that we look at with such sort of, at least on the left, with such sort of like admiration, Sweden, for example, is struggling with a far right issue right now that pivots on race. Mm. It pivots on migration, and it pivots on, we don't really want to spend our high tax rate on brown people and black people coming from Africa and from the Middle East. And then the values thing starts to get a little messy, I feel, because it's like gay and lesbian issues are used as kind of an indicator of one's liberal democratic values. Mm. But that is so far from our reality right now that it's starting to kind of wear thin. Like when I'm hearing sort of statements on the homophobia of Palestinians, for example, right, I'm like, well, you may want to look at home too, because a lot of people are really not feeling safe right now and are feeling very threatened, quite honestly, and feeling erased. But if you think about the material threats on people's lives, you know, especially in Florida, as a teacher in Florida, you can now be fired quite legally for even mentioning gender or sexuality in the classroom. And that includes if you are a gay and lesbian or trans instructor, and you want to mention your partner. I mean, I had a student who was from Florida, two dads, and was watching all this from Vanderbilt saying, I'm glad I'm not in school, but what about my little sister who can no longer mention our family? So, I mean, that's a level of—
That's real.
It's real for us. And I don't think we want to come to terms with that. So in terms of looking at other cultures, it's very important not to other and say, well, we're so progressive. We just overturned Roe versus Wade. there were 540 bills, anti-LGBTQ+ bills passed or proposed in this year alone. Hmm. I don't think that we are who we think we are a lot of times, you know?
No, I totally agree with you. No difference of opinion at all. And I talk about this a lot. Change subject here for a minute. Elon Musk, South African, pure white eugenicist upbringing, is a good mesh for what we see. It seems to be very apropos of the tech bro culture and what they've produced. And this is a genuine question. You didn't put this in your book, but not only do I agree with what you're saying in this conversation here just now, but I would go a step further, and I would just say that the kind of technocratic tech bro approach to technology, which was going to promise so much and bring everybody together, and instead the algorithms wrote us all into separate little bubbles that never talk to each other. You know, social media is the biggest, you know, joke in the world in terms of just the name. It's the most antisocial thing that's ever happened. And It seems to me that it often reflects the character of the kind of white supremacist mentality about the way the whole world looks to these billionaires. They don't give a shit about my grandchildren. They could care less about the quality of life of young women growing up in America or the trans community or anybody else. And they know perfectly well what their algorithms are doing. So I think the cruelty that you talk about in your book, the kind of apotheosis of it, and the best example that perhaps history has ever provided is what social media has done, both in enriching a few people who happen to be white and American, and the climate in which the rest of us feel so disempowered. I after we're done here, I'll be going to the school and pick up my granddaughter, who's the youngest of five grandchildren. And I've done with my wife, Jeannie, all their childcare for the last 15 years, the youngest. And I'll be cooking for her and taking care of her and so forth. I have many conversations with young parents in the playground where we wait for the kids. All of them say the same thing. If only they could figure some way to get the cell phone away from fill in the blank. None of them feel they're able to do it. And something in me is screaming, well, why are we all going along with this? Fill in the blank, whatever it is that's as... And the parental unit in America feels under attack from the billionaires. They've given us a world in which we've had no say whatsoever, and it never turns out to be as advertised. And that hardness, I think, really does come from the white supremacist, capitalist, industrial culture we live in. Everybody says so. Nobody can do a thing about it. I'm just throwing this out to you as someone who's written a book that touches on the root of this problem.
Yeah. I mean, I try not to be too tech pessimistic, but it's very difficult to not be, right? I mean, I think that if you could hear my story, and this is partly why I was so excited to come on your show, because I have a feeling you have a very different listening audience than I'm used to.
Yeah.
And hear a trans person talk about their experience.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that is a very unusual thing these days. And I think it has to do very much with the privatization of everything and the loss of public space as well. Like the loss of the public square in material sense, right?
Yeah.
Leads us to these digital public squares, which are essentially screaming matches a lot of the time. Or it's the sort of dopamine hit that you get from being with like-minded folks in affinity groups. So part of Unruly Alliance to me, I mean, I think it can happen online, but I honestly think that what I'm talking about is actual human interaction as well.
Yeah.
Because I think that what I've learned through COVID, I taught a lot online, and it was at the end of the day, like, it was not effective. It didn't work. I tried my best to engage students online. I worked a lot with them on dealing with their issues at home, because a lot of trans and LGBTQ plus people in general were kicked out of their homes during COVID. And all of this hysteria around book banning, which was my other passion, went viral alongside COVID-19 at that time. And I think social media plays a role there too, because a lot of these books, images, and texts were taken out of context, shared as social media posts on Instagram, and used to villainize an author or a book. So I think Unruly Alliance, you know, is something that can begin online, right? You and I corresponded through technological mediation to meet each other, right? But then I think the conversation needs to take place in forums like this, where we're actually meeting and wrestling with different viewpoints. I think this whole thing of agreement is really a problem, that in order to talk to you, I have to agree with you, or we're going to end up, you know, tearing each other apart That's not civil society to me.
Right.
That's not a place that I want to live, certainly. Mm. And I think it has to do, though, not so much with changes in individual humanity. I mean, that's part of it, but it has to do with the structures around us just compressing and compressing. For example, one can't market a book now without social media. You can't do it.
That's right.
You have to have a presence unless you don't care about being read, which a lot of my academic friends don't. And I just happened to, because I didn't
hold
write
your book
a book
up
to
again.
I didn't write a book to be read by the 10 friends who were with me at the time.
Right.
Sorry, the sun's kind of coming in. So yeah. I mean, I'm with you. And I also think that I'm glad I didn't grow up with social media.
Me too.
Because I think that it's putting so much pressure on kids to conform.
Well, and another caveat to that, I'm glad I wrote a book called Sex, Mom, and God a long time ago, which, people were interested in. But I'm very glad that none of my developmental sexuality was in the glare of online porn on my phone.
Yeah.
So whether you're gay, straight, trans, don't give a shit. The introduction to human sexuality now being experienced, talk about male dysfunction.
Yeah.
Katie, bar the door. You know, I'm a male. I get that. And I understand the function of sexuality in my own life. And Jeannie and I have been together a very long time. And I think we've learned a thing or two about human relationships.
Yeah.
There's some things I do actually have some idea about. This is one of them. And I know that my first experience of sexuality was a girl in the village in Switzerland who happened to be the pastor's daughter, not to do with our religious community, but the village state church. And she was 13. I think I was 13. I held her hand. We spent the summer together. We were friends before I kissed her. It was a huge deal one day when I saw her breast while we were making out. That introduction was a preparatory moment for some other relationships, one of which, when Jeannie and I got pregnant, when she got pregnant, we were 17 and 18, people say, you know, how did you manage to stay together? And there's, you know, there's a big story there, and I've written some things about it. But one of the reasons why is that, in spite of the fact that I was being raised in an evangelical environment in which males were portrayed as the head of the home and so forth, sex itself was something that was pitched as important. And the line between relationship and sexuality had not been completely severed. You know, people talk about the pill severing the line between procreation and sexuality. I don't think that's the big deal. Contraceptives always been used, even if it's just in abstinence. The big deal that's new, there is something new, and that is there's a whole generation that has never been introduced to the idea at all that sexuality may have something to do with friendship. Sexuality may have something to do with manners. Sexuality may have something to do with consent. Sexuality may have to do with feeling. And nobody, I was taught this in a way in my Christian background, but in a larger way, it was what I didn't see and know was just as important for me. And I think I think our culture has suffered a massive blow by the derailment of aspects of the sexual revolution that were good. And all of a sudden it turned out that Bob Guccione, Hugh Hefner, and Johnny Carson were in charge. And now we have Elon Musk, and there's a direct line, and it's all these white male fantasies being played out that are right on the margin of abuse and rape from day one. And now this is where 10-year-olds are living.
Yeah, I mean, you want to match that up with the total dearth of sexual education, comprehensive sex ed in schools, and the fact that the noose is tightening around what little there was there. But I think that in general, the way that it's always been taught, and parents, of course, play a role. I mean, I remember, you know, my mom just gave me Where Do I Come From? I forget who the author, I can see the book now, so I just remember it so clearly, because it was like we went to the mall to get a new outfit, and then I was given the book and she kind of walked away.
Yeah.
And I was left with this information. I mean, I don't think my story's not typical, never mind whether you have a non-normative or relationship to sexuality. That's something that you have to find out on your own through trial and error, and sometimes through nefarious sources as well. But I think that if we want to solve the problem of consent, for example, then we would need to turn toward an approach that is comprehensive sex ed in schools, because I don't think that parents are always, you know, up for the task either. I think it needs to be available in schools, but we're so far from that reality. And I often laugh with my students that if I ever don't have a lesson plan and I just want to riff on something, all I need to say is, tell me your experiences with sex ed, and they are tearing it up. Because some of it is everything from carry around a baby and make a budget for the doll, you know, carry the doll around for a week so that you can learn the consequences of your actions, which has never worked, to this very sort of biological, sterile, as you said, like not about relationship, not about humanity, really about the facts of disease as well. And I don't know where we are going to go from here with this current situation that we're in politically, and especially now that books that are considered by a small minority, usually of people, to be off limits are now put in glass cases where a student has to come and ask to take out the book, which is a humiliating gesture. And I started teaching a graphic novel called Genderqueer to a class at Vanderbilt in 2018, thought nothing of it. It was a sweet story that was, there were a few graphic moments that were really designed for young adults. It was not a children's book by any means, which is some of the problem with graphic novels and how they're categorized. But comes to find out that in 2023, at least for the data from last year, it's the most banned book in the country. I never, ever would have anticipated that. It did not strike me as something that could be in the realm of possibility. So I think that it may be important to talk about the uniqueness of our moment. And even from your perspective, as 71 years old, where we are now does feel uniquely authoritarian to me, and also very much anti-relational in terms of across the board, I would say.
Yeah. One listener just said on the live stream, we did it. We took the phone and it's been great. A whole different kid. So, you know, there are parents who rebel. I want to just talk a little more about the the cultural moment we find ourselves in, the political moment, the religious moment, this kind of push towards theocracy globally. And I never, you know, speaking of 71, I never would have anticipated this in the mid 60s. You know, I don't know if you remember who Christopher Hitchin was, the you know, the new atheist guy who did all the writing and so on, but and then wrote for Vanity Fair. But I used to talk to him after he read my memoir, Crazy for God, and he liked it. And he would call me once in a while and talk and ask me, you know, why aren't you one of us? Why aren't you part of the new atheist movement? In those days, I was sort of ambivalent. You know, I'm still on a spiritual journey. I'm more sort of clearly atheist these days, but it brings up a point. And that is, if I look back at what I was writing in my 40s, I think I wrote my memoir when I was 50, and I'd written novels like Portofino, set in the evangelical milieu that had been with Penguin and Macmillan and people like that. And then after that, people wanted to know, well, how much of this is real? So I thought, okay, I'm 50, I'll write a memoir. But looking back on various books I've written or my talks with Christopher Hitchens and some of the other new atheists like Daniel Dennett back in the day, it occurs to me that a question I'd like to go to here to kind of wrap this up with you is, in terms of what you've learned about yourself and your own evolving views of yourself, but also the world, obviously you understand that as you project your own thinking out into the future, 20 years from now, you will be writing and thinking things very different from today. And what has surprised me is how radical my own journey became. I never, never, never would have imagined that there'd come a day when I describe myself as a left-wing atheist. And it wasn't a rebellion against anything. It was not, and nobody who knew me at any other stage would have ever figured that. And my life's evolved in other ways in terms of caregiving. You know, it went from being on the road a lot, earning my living as a writer and so forth and so on. And then, you know, to full-time childcare for these kids so that my daughter-in-law and son can both have careers, along with my wife, you know, doing all the stuff and so forth, getting the most joy I've ever had out of life from these activities. There have been a lot of changes. So your book has a very definite point of view. And it argues against certainty, but in the same way that I often do, sometimes looking back ruefully, I say, yeah, I seem pretty certain about my uncertainty. And I'm wondering how you see yourself on your journey, how you may be changing, and even now looking at this book, what you do differently, and extrapolating that out, you know, where are you headed?
Well, I think that I'm interested to see how being a part of this community changes how I write and think and feel, because it's a very special place right now within all these arguments. It's surrounded by red states, Kentucky, Missouri, and there are two abortion clinics in a town of 20,000 people, and it's gotten a lot of national press, you know? Again, there are divides within the community, but I think that what I lacked when I wrote this book was a real sense of community outside of my family that I was living with. And I think those interactions, I'm open to those shaping me. And I think that, you know, I totally agree with you that, you know, I end on that note in the book, which is opening oneself to uncertainty and chance. And that's the only way that we can find creative, novel solutions to what I see as a relational problem in the United States right now, which is where I'm situated, which is where I live, which is where I have to deal with, you know, the climate that we're in right now. And also, you know, that we have a lot of trans refugees coming here from red states, and we're helping those folks to come from Tennessee, Oklahoma, Texas, and the bonds that I'm forming within what is really an Africana diaspora studies. It's the School of Africana Multicultural Studies is where I'm housed. I'm learning all the time from my colleagues about their experiences. And in some ways it deepens my points of view in the book, and in other ways I can see where things could have been expanded or changed. But it is what it is. And it was hard won because, like I said, it was never supposed to be my path. I was never supposed to be an academic. I was never supposed to be a thinking person, really. And that's really kind of interesting how that shapes up. And I'm open to how this community impacts my insights because, like I said, it's small and there's a lot of mutual aid. There's a lot of care going on in this community, and I've never lived or haven't lived in a long time in a community of 20,000 people in such a political moment that we're in now, you know?
Yeah, and I think everything is heightened because of that moment, and it just keeps getting more, you know, you keep thinking, okay, well, Trump, that's it. That's, you know, it's midnight and the clock on the Times page is turning and Trump's going to win. This has to be we're still going to do January 6th. We're going to storm. No, okay, well, we're going to have COVID. We're going to all be in our own houses. And all right, okay, now it looks like we're going to be drawn into a Middle Eastern war, having been out of Afghanistan for 10 seconds. I just, you know, I've been...
yeah, literally.
Yeah, I mean, you have to go back into the pre-Renaissance era of the Black Death or Edward III in the UK and the Hundred Years' War launched with France to sort of get a comparable moment. I mean, it just seems intense, which means that everybody's intensity is ramped up because we're on flight or fight mode all the time now, just because of what's going on.
Yeah, I think about that. I mean, and I think that that's where it comes back to in the individual sense. I mean, there's care in the larger political sense, but the care that I've heard you talk about in previous episodes is really important wherever that care might take place, and the unexpectedness of those moments that might arise where you didn't even think that it would, and to stay open, just even open a little tiny bit to the possibility that an interaction with someone who's very different from you could transform your point of view, maybe a starting point, something like that.
Yeah, and I don't think the transformation for me, just speaking for me personally, ever happens politically. You know, I have my friend down the street who puts up a big Trump sign and flew his flag upside down when Obama was elected and so forth, but also welded the doors on a outdoor pizza oven I built for myself, knows who we are, always crosses the street to say hello and so forth. He's the fact that I like him and he likes me is not changing my politics. I don't view Trump any differently, but I dislike Trump supporters less as humans. Yeah. And really, you know, the old phrase there, but for the grace of God go I, I'm more willing to look at whatever path his has been over his lifetime, which, by the way, in this particular gentleman's case has been fraught, lots and lots and lots of hard things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think that it would come to a point where I wouldn't speak any better of Trump, and I still would dismiss people who vote for Republicans these days as agents of evil, not to cut it, to beat around the bush. But that said, on where it's good is sort of the humility of saying, yeah, but, you know, on a human level, picturing being stuck on a desert island with this person, you know, we would find a way to get on because there's a commonality there. And I think that's where I'm lucky that I've stayed in one neighborhood for 43 years and walk up the street every morning with my dog and know everybody. And there's not anybody I don't speak to because they vote some way. That wouldn't happen without the conversations, the many that have added up. And I think that's kind of a pre-internet reality of not living in this bubble, but actually living someplace. And I think that's maybe what you're talking about in your community.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that we also have to take into account the fact that the media ecosystem right now is brainwashing people. And I've not found that education really works, at least not in my classroom. Like when I have students come at me with this totalizing set of views, which is not the same as sort of conversations we've had about why I use whiteness in a certain way or what have you. These are totalizing views that will not budge. And I've also had a number of students tell me that they have a similar story to yours, which is that they left the family behind at 21 years old, right? Left the pro-life movement, left the March for Life rallies behind, left that whole world behind, which was coerced, you know, upon them, and are making their own way. And a lot of times that comes with a lot of consequences too. But it is really, I believe, it is really brainwashing.
Yeah.
It's really the effect of something that is lying to you all the time, e.g. Fox News, et cetera, et cetera. And I have to have some compassion for that, I feel, you know, that, you know, also the fact that news media has changed to the point where maybe in a different era, you would have looked at news and said, well, of course, they're telling the truth.
Yeah.
Right. Because that may have been more or less true in a certain era, like more or less, you know, but that's not true today. And so I think that gives me some grace for my father too, who, you know, was, you know, a lot of his various racisms and misogynies came out in that moment. And I think for him, it was a moment of grievance that, you know, I was promised a certain life and I wasn't given that life. And now I'm angry about it. And this person seems angry too. And let me take in and soak in all these other grievances to sort of churn away on that. But as you said, you know, I had a group of folks make my fence that they definitely do not share my politics. They were lovely to us. They were lovely to us. The neighbors thought differently. I thought of your story. The neighbors were a little bit like, who are these guys from the outback of Illinois making your fence? It was great. Like we had a lot to talk about on the level of spirituality that had actually nothing to do with Trump or whatever, you know.
Well, we will wrap this up. And my producer sent you a little message. Ernie says, let's stay in touch with Allison in the spirit of care and unruly alliances. And next time we'll talk a little more about your relationship with your wife and just your life. And the book, once again, that I hope people do, as she is holding it up there, which I've asked her to do, is Masculinity and Transition. It's just out. It's available. It's a good read. And you will enjoy it and be stimulated by it. So I hope sometimes you write a book for the popular press and not just academic, because watching your interest in films, I know you can write a book for the, I get mainstream press is the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
I think that would be fun. Yeah, I think that'd be great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You have it in you. And then we'll do another conversation.
Awesome.
So Allison, I'll end by thanking you and saying, please let me and let Ernie know if there's anything we can do for you in any way. And Ernie will post the links to everything. So any way you want to be linked to or helped, we will help you. So
thank you.
Let Ernie know what you need, and we are at your disposal to help you. And if it's anything personal, you can get in touch with me, and I'm there as a friend if you need something.
Thank you. I think linking just to the Amazon page for the book
we'll do all that.
Would be great. Yeah,
all Ernie's going to do it all.
Great. Okay. Thank you all so much. This was great. Have a good day.
Yeah, much love to you and your wife.
Thank you. You too. And to your family. Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
In Conversation with Frank Schaefer is a production of the George Bailey Morality and Public Life Fellowship. It is produced by Ernie Gregg and hosted by Frank Schaefer, author of Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, Be Happy, a post-pandemic blueprint for rebalancing work and family in favor of love and living. To learn more and support the show, please visit lovechildrenplanet.com.